Welcome to the Corporate Innovation Podcast, presented by Singularity University and in collaboration with Singularity U Nordic. My name is Chris Ostergaard. The purpose of this podcast is to go beyond the disrupt or die headlines, get concrete about all the abstract terminology behind innovation, and into the nitty-gritty of how to truly create transformation, growth, and impact by speaking to world-leading doers and thinkers who have a lot of innovation dirt under their nails. I hope the podcast provides value for you and hereby give you the next guest on the Corporate Innovation Podcast. So we're here on the Corporate Innovation Podcast today with David G. White Jr. So David is a PhD partner and co-founder of Ontos Global. He's a cognitive anthropologist who focuses on new approaches to organizational culture and change based on the emerging science of the cultural mind. He has a new book called Disrupting Corporate Culture: How Cognitive Science Alters Accepted Beliefs About Culture and Culture Change, and its impact on leaders and change agents. And we are talking about exactly that: corporate culture. What is it? What is it not? And how to really, truly transform corporate culture. But first off, welcome here on the podcast, David.
Thank you so much. Great to be here. Appreciate it.
Thank you. So before we throw ourselves into it, always interesting to learn a little bit about a guest's journey. So what brought you from A to B to C to writing a book called Disrupting Corporate Culture?
Yes, well, my journey, I think, like many people's, is filled with wrong turns and fits and starts and blind alleys and the restarts, etc. I was, but basically, to keep it simple, I've been a practitioner in working in organizations, large and small, for about 30 years. I've been in human resources, organizational development. I've also been an entrepreneur and started my own software company, and worked in very large companies like IBM and Microsoft for many years, driving large-scale transformation. And only at the tender age of 48 did I realize that all of the large-scale transformation efforts, culture transformation, business transformation efforts that I'd been a part of, especially that dealt with managing, trying to manage culture in some planned way, never worked. Despite great leaders, very talented colleagues, great vision, compelling business cases, culture change never seemed to go the way we wanted it to go. And I got very interested in that question, which led me to get my PhD in my late 40s and go back to school and study cognitive anthropology and kind of a hybrid of all the cognitive sciences as they relate to this topic of culture. And there's a tremendous amount of work that's been going on in the last 30 years on this topic. Most of it is out of sight of the business community for several reasons. This book essentially represents the culmination of 10 years of research and a PhD and a previous book, which was an academic book on the same topic. But it's an attempt to really bridge the world of the cognitive science of culture, which is mainly the focus of cognitive anthropology and cognitive sociology, a few other related subfields, and the business community, and trying to sort of build a bridge between those two worlds and really help leaders and practitioners with much more sophisticated and up-to-date ideas about culture and culture change.
Wonderful. I am imagining, and from own experience, not really any leaders out there who are not thinking a lot about culture and how to strengthen culture or even entirely transform culture, right? And there are a lot of myths around corporate culture and the importance of culture and what it is, etc. And you're debunking quite the number of myths in your book. And one of them that really struck me, just to start on a controversial note, but we can talk about many of them, is that culture drives business performance. Mm-hmm. And so maybe we kick it off there. Does culture not drive business performance, or what's the gist here?
Well, yeah, you went right into the heart of the matter. There's two very controversial myths. That's one. The other is that the culture comes from the top, from the leaders. To un- unpack that question requires taking a step back and thinking a little bit about how the cognitive sciences, cognitive neuroscience thinks about, neurosciences think about culture. In the cognitive conception, again, developed over the last 30 years, we think of culture as knowledge. And essentially, it's background knowledge. It's what we know but don't know that we know, but we make use of that knowledge every day in millions of ways. And it's from everything from, you know, knowing, you know, how do you know when you get on an elevator in an office building not to look people in the eye? Mm. Or how do you know what to do when you get onto a metro platform, you know, in Stockholm? And how do you navigate the platform? Or how do you know how to walk the streets of the sidewalks, you know, in your community? These are so basic. They're tacit knowledges, tacit information that we have about how to conduct ourselves in the world. And it's learned experientially. It's learned throughout our lives. And it's learned neurologically, right? These are chemical processes in the brain that we have learned through our bodily experience of being in the world. That's you know, in essence, the cognitive science view of culture. We call it a reference system. Think of it like an operating system that runs in the background, just like Windows or the, you know, iOS system runs on your computer or your smartphone. And we don't know it's there until we have to make use of it in some way. So this idea that somehow what's happened in the business community over the last 20, 30, 40 years in the interest in culture, which really spawned in the 1980s, was somehow that if we could get people normatively to do the right thing, whatever that means, that somehow that would be instrumental in driving business performance. It's a very compelling idea because, you know, as knowledge, culture does have some impact on business performance. But the fallacy or the mistake that has been made in the business community over these years is thinking of culture as some kind of dependent variable. That if I could just, you know, like it has with inputs and outputs, if I just sort of manipulate the culture, do something to the culture, it will produce an outcome. It's what I call the black box model of culture, you know, input, output, right? Mm. It's a very common mistake to make because first off, business leaders are pragmatists. We want results. We're not interested in culture per se. We're interested in the outcomes of culture. You know, how do we get people to do better things more efficiently, more effectively, more humanly, et cetera. Very noble goals. But there's been an attribution error made to culture, to think of culture as somehow this variable that we can somehow manipulate the way we manipulate machinery or capital, you know, or even, you know, manipulate people to some extent to gain a business outcome. Mm. Culture does relate to business performance, so that there is a connection, but it's a much more indirect connection, in the same way that the Windows operating system relates to the performance of your computer, of your laptop. There is a relationship between culture and business performance, but it's not a straight line, linear relationship. It's far more complex and far more subject to variability.
So maybe
that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe let's unpack that a little bit, right? Because there's plenty, and you also point to that in the book, there are plenty of articles, books, etc., out there, and studies as well that, you know, claim then that there is this direct correlation between culture and, you know, how well your business is performing, right? And you're saying, yeah, well, there's a relationship, but it's far more indirect. So let's talk a little bit about what some of those roundabouts relationships are, perhaps.
Yeah, well, you know, part of the reason why these studies exist is, and if you read, you know, I can't say I've read all of them, but I've read a good number of them, certainly the most popular ones, and, you know, spent 10 years researching this question. Most of these studies will reduce culture to a single variable and then claim based on that variable that it drives business performance. Mm-hmm. That's a nebulous, that's a spurious claim. If you unpack any of those books, the most popular books, you know, Peters and Waterman, I mean, or, you know, even Good to Great, I mean, you know, these notions hinge on thinking of culture as a single variable, like values or norms. And while culture certainly has a relationship to values or norms, to reduce culture to one thing, you can then begin to see that when you do that, then it becomes a little easier to create an equation effectively that links culture to business performance. It's also no wonder that most of the people that study culture in business are economists or IO psychologists. These are disciplines that have not put culture at the center of their agendas. Anthropologists have been studying culture for 100 years, but anthropologists haven't really cared too much about studying business. And so you see the gap, right? Economists will try to reduce things to an equation to essentially eliminate the variables in the equation to then produce an outcome, a predictable outcome. It's again a very reasonable, well-intended approach, but the cognitive view would say that it's not linear in any such way at all. So these studies are based, in my opinion, are flawed in methodologically because culture is reduced to a dependent variable. And therefore, when you have a dependent variable, you can basically prove anything. Mm. So to unpack it to your question, sorry for the long answer, but to get to the question then, I'll reduce it to sort of the most basic terms. If culture is a reference system, it lives in the mind. As such, it lives in neurochemical processes in our synapses. The way we actually change what we know from neuroscience is the way we change neurochemical processes in the brain is to actually change habits and routines. So you want to lose 10 pounds or quit smoking, right? The modern conception of how to do that is all going to be based on changing actual physical practices, changing your bodily habits daily. Because to produce a sustained outcome requires changes in routines and processes and habits. This is what I call practices. So culture change in the modern conception really comes down to changing organizational practices that allow people to learn new habits and new routines, new ways of being in the world that allow new chemical processes to form in the brain. And so what happens, you know, when you go to the gym or when you try to quit smoking or lose 10 pounds or et cetera, is no different than what happens in organizations. You have to inculcate new habits and routines to help drive a business outcome. And so this is how, conceptually, that sounds pretty straightforward. Many business leaders, I think when I speak about this to them, understand this intuitively very well. Where it gets complicated is in practice, because changing habits and routines of an organization of 100,000 people is not easy. Mm-hmm. And most of these habits and routines are not just in the HR people realm. It's not just about how you hire or how you promote or how you develop people or how you include people. Those things matter. But what matters rather more are your everyday business practices at the core of your business. How you set budgets, how you plan, how do you deliver value to customers? How do you drive product development? How do you drive innovation? How do you think about management reporting? How do you manage the business on a day-to-day? These practices are at the core of the cultural reference system. And to change culture requires changes to those kinds of practices, in obviously in alignment with some vision. Mm. So that's a long journey back to a very good question that you asked.
Well, it's not easy stuff, right? And what you're also pointing to, I think, which I've encountered many times also, both, you know, with, you know, conscious knowledge of it or not, the notion of action creates mindset or mindset creates action, and it's action, right? That's the chicken or the egg. I don't know.
That's exactly right. Yeah. We say culture follows task.
Yeah, I don't think, in my experience at least, that isn't necessarily intuitive knowledge, because it points to also, I think, one of the other myths, at least partly. I want you to unpack the myths rather than me interpreting, right? But the importance of the leader, if you like. Leader saying something, then it happens, which is more to the, let's talk about what we want to have happen, and then that will then create a change, right? And that's not how it goes.
Well, certainly leaders have a big role to play in culture, so I'm not going to deny that, but it's much more complex than it, right? Yeah. And as you said, simply a CEO making pronouncements or making brilliant speeches or great town hall meetings is not enough by any shape, any means to drive any kind of culture change. Where leaders play, the role that leaders do play in culture change, which is which is, I think, underappreciated and much more complicated, is in setting agendas and allocating resources and putting attention onto a domain, an area of opportunity, and holding, driving accountability, holding people accountable, right? And so in these particular ways, when leaders do that, practices get generated typically that then set in motion culture or culture change. And that's the connection. So if a leader wants to drive culture change, their number one idea is to be thinking about how am I allocating resources? How am I establishing the agenda for change? How am I holding people accountable? How am I organizing ourselves in order for those practices to take shape that then drive the culture change? Again, conceptually, it's not that hard to draw a diagram out that, sort of create an architecture for how that would work in any organization, but doing it is difficult because often it requires changes to practices or organizational habits and routines that companies hold very dear. Like if I want to talk to you about how to change your budgeting practices as a means to drive culture change, most likely there's going to be resistance. Most likely there's going to be, we can't do that. We've been doing it that way for 30 years and we know it works and this is what the market requires. And right. And so this is where, we talked briefly earlier at the outset about companies, manufacturing companies trying to undergo digital transformation and how fundamentally different the digital mindset is to industrial manufacturers. It's almost like speaking, Swahili in a company where only English is spoken, right? It's fundamentally different, and the differences relies in those fundamental practices.
Yeah, and so sticking to the leaders here, right? One question I often hear is, where should change come from, right? Should it come from the top? Should it come from the bottom? The top leader versus other leaders, middle management, etc. Can it come from everywhere and really help create a sustainable culture change? What's your insights on that?
Yeah, well, I think the short answer is yes.
Right.
Everywhere. Leaders have obviously played a key role in establishing vision. As I said, setting the agenda. Here's what we're going to do, here's what we're not going to do, right, et cetera. Very, very, very important. And that's setting a direction for the company. Middle management, though, has to play the key role in either designing and or implementing the practice changes that are required because they live the practices. So if we're going to talk about budgeting or planning or management reporting, it's, the folks in the middle are the ones who live that every day. And they're the ones where the habits and routines have to be shaped. And often, as we know from basic approaches to organizational change, it's very difficult to change anybody unless they are enrolled and are part of that change themselves and have a hand in designing it or shaping it for themselves. Right. So the answer is in organizational change as well as in culture change. Change has to happen both at the top and at the middle and at the bottom, essentially. And of course, organizing that and controlling that in any kind of predictable way is very difficult. Mm. The other thing about culture that's worth mentioning here is if we take a step back and think about culture as a reference system, at the core of the reference system are what we call dominant logics. These are sort of dominant assumptions or core assumptions about the world. Anthropologists call them cultural schemas. I use the word dominant logic because it's a little more palatable for business people, but it's tacit, implicit assumptions about how the world works, how customers work, how the company works, that can be, I think of it as source code or DNA that then can be traced throughout an organization's practices. It's understanding those dominant logics is where the key to culture change resides. Because once you get to the source code, you can actually start to change the apps and the operating system, but you have to intervene at the source code level. And that's where culture change gets really interesting. Once you start understanding the foundational logics by which you run your business, the foundational assumptions that you make about customers, about product, about people, about change, even about yourself as a leader. Once you start unpacking those, that's where the culture change really begins. So you can, and it's really about a process of gaining deep insight and deep self-awareness to start to understand, I've been making these assumptions about how the world works or about how customers work or about how our technology works, for 5 years. And I realize those assumptions are potentially flawed. Or based on a mental model that's rooted in, an industrial 1950s mindset that's not incompatible with today's needs, for example.
But what if vision doesn't come from management, right? I mean, what if the scenario is an organization, I'm sure you've heard that more times than I have heard, and people who have, some power, but not a lot of power, they are like, we really need change and we really need to transform culture, but I'm just not seeing it from leadership. Yeah. What can they do? What should they do?
Well, that's an interesting scenario. In the book, I talk about where culture comes from. It comes from the brain, of course, but it comes from two sources. And this relates to your question. One, the two dominant sources of where culture emerges, where these reference systems emerge, one is the task of the organization, the core means of production. What you do all day as a business shapes how you think. That's the fundamental notion of cognitive anthropology, cognitive approaches to culture. And so companies that make software are going to just naturally think very differently than companies that make refrigerators or companies that make engines, airplane engines, right? Or versus cosmetics, versus NGOs, versus universities, right? So the task shapes the brain, which shapes the culture. The other big source of culture in organizations is the dominant occupational group. So this gets to your question. So in organizations, dominant occupational groups will impart the logics to the organization. Think of engineers and software companies, doctors and HMOs, actuaries and insurance companies, et cetera, social workers in NGOs, right? The professionalization of those occupational groups, the process of becoming a doctor or an airline pilot or a lawyer, shape the thinking. When those groups have power in an organization, the culture change within that organization can be linked back to the influence and power that those occupational groups have, because they impart the dominant logics to make the organization, through which the organization has become successful. So this is, I spent many years in Microsoft, for example, and the software engineering community inside Microsoft has an outsized influence on the direction of that company, as it should. You would not expect human resources professionals at Microsoft to have a huge hand in shaping the organization, or even marketers, because the company historically has been very, very engineering driven back to the days of Bill Gates and the DOS operating system. And to this day, engineering provides a very, the engineering logics of software engineering are foundational to that company's broader reference system.
Yeah.
So I think it gets to your question. It's a great question. I think change has to be linked in some way to power. And where it doesn't have to necessarily reside at the top, but it has to reside in an occupational group that has influence in the organization, in my opinion.
Yeah. And so maybe you are part of that dominant group in a company, right? Maybe you are not. Maybe you're an auxiliary function or whatever. But if you're that person who is seeing, hey, we need to do something, right? And let's say you're a department lead or something, right? What's your advice to them on saying, how can they take the first step and in order to help the company realize that we need to go on a culture change journey?
Yeah, well, first, my perspective on that question would be, just as I said a minute ago, is try to develop an understanding of where the power does reside in the organization. So become aware, right? See the system, which is difficult in and of itself, as you know. The second thing I would say is, which is advice I give to leaders in general, is When you think of culture through this new paradigm of reference systems and dominant logics, et cetera, and when you start to see and understand systems in that way, you start to actually see the cultural patterns, the dominant logic patterning a lot of practices in the organization. The number one thing that a change leader can do that is, I think, most impactful as a starting point to your question is illuminate the patterns, illuminate how the dominant logics play out in the organization. I'll give you an example. One of our clients, and this is very true of industrial companies in general, the way industrial companies approach risk is for good reason, very, very dominant in their thinking. You know, it's very, the cost of failure when you're making an aircraft engine or a refrigerator or a HVAC unit or a pump is very high. You can't just sort of, you know, recall products from the market. In software or in data-based businesses, you know, the cost of failure is very low. You have you routinely ship software with known bugs. Because why? Because you know in 2 weeks you'll have another release and it'll correct those bugs. And there'll be new bugs. So the mindset, the dominant logic around risk in an industrial is very, very different. That companies, though, can take that dominant logic much too far, and that really becomes a barrier to change because they then become risk-averse in all of their practices, the way they hire, the way they promote, the way they drive product innovation, the way they talk to customers. You know, you go through all of these practice areas. So what a leader can do that's most, in my opinion, extremely valuable as a change leader is to start to illuminate how these patterns show up in these different practices in the organization. And once you understand the dominant logic and how it works, you can see it patterning various practices across the organization, risk being, you know, risk management practices being. And then you start to ask questions. Well, why is it that we, you know, never promote people into senior leadership roles unless they've done that job before, for example? Well, it's because we can't take a risk on anybody. Well, why not? Why can't you take a risk on, you know, yes, I understand you want to be risk, you know, somewhat risk averse in our product manufacturing processes, but do we need to extend that logic into the way we hire or the way we promote or the way we plan or the way we budget, you know, et cetera. You get the point. Yeah.
This episode is presented in partnership with Singularity University. If the future you've been planning for arrived today, would your organization be prepared? If your answer is anything other than a resounding yes, you might be in danger of falling behind your competition. In the race of innovation, your success depends on your ability to adapt and start thinking and acting exponentially. Singularity University can help you develop a future-focused mindset and toolset and connect you to a global community of changemakers just like you. Come explore the future of exponential technologies, learn how other organizations are adapting to change, and build a strategy that keeps your organization at the top of your game no matter what the future brings. Take charge of your future. Visit su.org/CIP to learn more.
Yeah, so the risk culture, if you like, is so dominant that regardless of whatever function or action inside of the organization, they are being taken with that risk culture as the foundation here. And then the question becomes, yes, it makes sense when you are producing your aircraft, but does it make sense when you are in HR in certain activities, for instance? And exactly. By doing that analysis and addressing this, then that is an opportunity to start changing culture by diversifying. I don't know if that's the right word, but, you know, adopting different risk profiles, perhaps in different parts of the organization.
Exactly. And to your question, the change leader becomes very, very valuable as the person holding the mirror and illuminating how the logics shape the practices. Requires a little bit of discipline. But again, like any journey of self-awareness or system awareness, once you start to see the system, you start to see how these logics are emerge. Obviously, in large, complex organizations like, you know, like a Microsoft or a Siemens or a ABB, I mean, this is a complex process.
Yeah.
And it's easier in smaller companies. But the discipline is the same.
Mm. One thing I've seen often, and I'm curious as to your thinking and insights about this, is the whole notion of organizations, you know, stating and taking initiatives as to digital transformation or whatever language they choose to use. But one of the barriers that they come upon is the lack of motivation, which really is part not so much in human resistance to change as in the system doesn't incentivize really what they're talking about, KPIs being one of those things, right? Whereas, yeah, we need to disrupt ourselves, but by the way, the KPIs remain exactly the same. So what's your thinking around this in terms of when we talk about disrupting culture?
Yeah, and I devote a lot of ink in the book to this kind of problem. And your point about KPIs is exactly right. KPIs are a product of a industrial mindset, you know, that has to control and manage for certainty as many variables as possible. Again, because costs of failure are very high. It's all well intended, by the way. This is not, you know, people are being stupid or malicious. It's well intended, and that logic worked very well for 100 years in the 20th century. Problem is that the logics of digital, if you think in terms of agile, if you think in terms of iteration, you think in terms of design thinking concepts, you think in terms of fail fast, you think in terms of self-organization, you think in terms of driving initiative down to the lowest level of the organization. All of those and other kinds of competencies that are so important in the digital world, in essence, are almost like a virus. I hate to use this metaphor during these times, but you know, a virus in the organism, because the organism's antibodies are designed to attack and mitigate such risky behavior. You know, if management has to control the innovation activity that goes on down the chain of command. If you start doing something random over here, introducing a new agile software development process or the product development process in our, you know, in my chain of command, suddenly I don't know what you're doing, and you might produce an outcome that might be very risky. So these digital mindsets, these digital values and competences are fundamentally different for most industrial manufacturers. And so and to my knowledge, you know, very few companies have really figured out how to manage that this clash of cultures, this clash of worlds. You know, for example, GE tried to do this by segregating their digital business into a separate business unit right out here in my backyard in the San Francisco Bay Area, and that it didn't really work because the business ran effectively, but the rest of the organization had a hard time absorbing some of the technologies and some of the innovations coming out of that business. There's no clear answer. I think the directionally what leaders need to be thinking about in digital transformation, number one, is how does the prevailing dominant logic of our industrial business preclude or inhibit or act as viral antibodies against this change that we need to make? And then how can we start bit by bit addressing those antibodies? And I'm using that metaphor deliberately because, as you know, with any kind of intervention in antibodies, you have to be very careful that sometimes you don't kill the patient while you know, addressing the antibody, right? Because too much radical change. I would never, for example, in advise my industrial clients to change all of their practices at the same time to embrace digital, because that'd be extremely disruptive to the core business and you might kill the business. Yeah. So you have to do this very surgically, very intentionally, very deliberately, but you have to do it you have to do it. If that makes any sense.
Yeah. And so now in the book, you also address it a little bit here, talk about your experiences from Microsoft, right? Years back. And a transformation project that you concluded didn't really work. And I don't know how close you are to Microsoft now, but it looks like the transformation process that Microsoft has been going through since they onboarded the new CEO seems to be incredibly successful, right? What do you see here is that were the sort of core elements in it not working back then and it working for them now?
Yeah, I think Well, I will tell you that the popular press wants to put it all on Satya Nadella,
right,
and his wisdom. Satya is a brilliant man, and I had a chance to work with him and meet him a few times back in my day. But I would say it's a little bit more complicated than that. For me, from what I've read, and my informants that remain at Microsoft, many of us there's a big Microsoft diaspora. What I've read and what I understand is that it's been fundamental changes to practices, especially customer engagement practices, how Microsoft sales teams and marketing teams approach and engage customers in a pretty fundamentally different way. You know, the prevailing mindset at Microsoft, the prevailing logic at Microsoft was, we just put a lot of cool features into our product, our software, and people will buy it. This is why, one of the reasons why Windows as an operating system is so over-featured. I mean, there's so many things, I don't know if you use Windows, but there's so many features in the Windows operating system, I would take a lifetime to figure out how to use them all and why. From what I understand, part of that culture transformation has come in really fundamentally rethinking the practices associated with customer value, how customers derive value from our products. I think in really all domains of that business. And of course, similarly, embracing the operational aspects of running the cloud-based business instead of running a business that ships on computer disks, it's been also fundamental. But it's come down to practices, actual practices, not just pronouncements or posters or training programs or just hiring different people. I mean, those things, are really tinkering at the margins of culture change.
And so what was it back when you were involved in a huge project in Microsoft, right, where everyone did so many things right, yet you concluded it didn't really work?
We were in the mid-2000s embarked on trying to make Microsoft more customer-centric. And the way we approached it is we architected the talent management system. We were after trying to change the competency models and the career path models for all employees in the company to allow them to, by essentially defining a new set of behaviors through these competencies that then they would be measured and developed on, we would inculcate new ways of thinking, new ways of engaging with customers, and new ways of thinking about product and product development. It was a very well-intentioned effort. It was a huge effort. It took many, many years. But it was essentially an intervention in the HR system, in the HR talent management system. And I would classify it as a very deep but narrow intervention. It was sort of digging a very deep well when we needed to dig many wells, maybe not as deep. And again, it was sort of focused on one domain, the domain of how we hire, manage, and develop people. Very important. And we did achieve some interesting outcomes. We improved employee engagement significantly because people had career paths and had a much clearer sense of how do I get to the next level, or if I want to be division president, how that happens. That was all good. But it didn't really drive the intended outcomes around customer or customer value that we were after, because it was an HR-focused intervention versus an intervention across all major practice areas.
So what concretely should have been done differently then, if we have listeners out there who are in this, right? And whether, does it make sense to start one place, right? So what would you have seen, would have liked to see in order to increase likelihood of success?
Well, first off, we would have gotten a little crisper about what was it in the culture we were trying to change. Mm-hmm. And then surface again the logics, the dominant logics at the core of the culture, the DNA or the operating or the source code of the culture that seems to preclude that vision or inhibit that vision, and then trace that into practices that we could identify as barriers, because of the way we design products. It's very insular. I'm just making this up, but it's very insular. We don't have a lot of VOC. Voice of customer, or the way we get voice of customer into our product development is very narrow, very limited. I would have preferred, hindsight being what it is, of course, I would have preferred that we engage directly in intervening in those practices that embody the logic that we're trying to change, and change those practices, re-architect specific practices, and maybe do it in a particular division or a part of the business so we don't disrupt the entire business at the same time. Iterate, improve and iterate, but nonetheless get very deliberate about what are the practices that are precluding the desired end state, and go after it that way. And this is actually a conversation that I've had with many HR professionals since then. It, you know, to some extent, going back to our competency model and career path model work, it sometimes sometimes less is more if you're trying to drive behavior change, you know, in the realm of HR, a few very targeted behavioral changes that are embedded deeply into, or behavioral standards that are embedded deeply into practices, has far more impact than a wide range of standards that are published on a website but never implemented in actual practice, hiring practices, promotion practices, succession planning practices, etc.
Yeah.
So this is a kind of a wide set of interventions versus one narrow and deep intervention, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So let's look a little bit further into the future, right? Because digital transformation is the word right now, right? Everyone is doing it, or they should be doing it, right? It makes a lot of sense. We are seeing all of these technological developments, artificial intelligence developing at breakneck pace. To a larger and larger extent, we are and we will be able to automate, right? We will be able to, you know, give the task to the AIs. We will also increasingly be able to give the decision-making power to the AIs. And if you follow it long enough, I don't know what the timeline is, eventually you can imagine companies entirely run by AIs that, you know, they do the work, they make the decisions, right? So, but before we get to that, there is a lot of decision-making, right? What do we want them to decide? What do we want to insist on that human beings should still decide, right? Which is also an ethical question here. But the whole notion of culture, as we increasingly put more and more work on the AIs here, and which, you know, all things being equal, would mean that we need less people to actually run the businesses. What's your thinking around how this development, looking into the future, will impact culture and will mean for how leaders should think about designing culture?
Yeah, I begin the book with a little story about, you know, maybe in 50 to 75 years, this notion of corporate culture will be a quaint artifact of the late 20th century, you know, because it won't matter anymore, because human machine interfaces will run, you know, AI and human machine interfaces will run the world. It's not a simple question. For me, it does boil down, though, to the question of humanity, as in making leaders more human. You know, you're associated with Singularity University, so you know fully well what I'm speaking of here, is creating more humane, more self-aware, more leaders capable of helping humans developmentally emancipate themselves. Culture becomes hugely important in that quest, because for one, too many corporate culture initiatives tinker at the margins. They don't achieve anything except waste a lot of time and money, or they target, you know, they go after kind of what I would call a very sophisticated kind of brainwashing. You know, you become like us and, you know, achieve greatness, which for me is, it borders on unethical. It's very difficult to get people to change their values. And culture has kind of is a thin veneer for, you know, sort of capitalist sort of domination kind of questions that are right behind it. You know, if you get everybody to think the same way, then therefore we will rule the world. And those are, in my opinion, counterproductive endeavors. A more sophisticated understanding of culture along the lines proposed by cognitive science and cognitive anthropology allows us a much deeper view into really what makes organizations tick, what makes, why do humans and organizations do what they do. It allows a more sophisticated understanding of how we can create better AI, better tools, more developmentally oriented workplaces where we spend most of our lives. It seems to me that the greater knowledge of the DNA of culture, in the same way that greater knowledge of the DNA of the human body, only improves our ability to make better decisions. So that's my hope, longer term. I can't really foresee the future, but my hope is we're armed with better decision-making tools and frameworks so we make more humane, for better and more humane outcomes.
Mm. And then finally, there's this whole other big disruptor right now, which is the COVID-19 pandemic, right? And obviously, it's effectuated a lot of change in organizations. Primarily, of course, that the majority of people are working from home. That affects, culture, right? That affects behavior. It affects culture. What is your thinking around how to navigate this and how to, make the better out of this, regardless of all the tragedy revolving around the pandemic here, but maybe even turning this into a positive for one's culture ultimately?
Yeah, and I've been asked that question quite a bit. And for me, it comes back down to what we talked about earlier. What is culture ultimately? And what we see is, unfortunately, insofar as culture follows task, and culture relates closely to the core task of the organization, the core means of production of the organization. Organizations in this time, because of the economic impacts of COVID-19, have been doubling down on the dominant logics that already exist in the company. So, for example, companies that are more risk averse, that are, dominant logic of risk aversion, are more risk averse now than ever. And so we see actually culture, these cultures or these cultural logics at the core of these organizational systems become more and more prevalent. So to back into your question, I think the biggest cultural change or the biggest cultural impacts of the pandemic, in my opinion, are going to reside in cases where business models have been fundamentally transformed. I think of the airline industry or the hotel industry. Because culture follows task, where the business model is fundamentally disrupted is where you can see the biggest culture change. I think simply working from home and being on Zoom all day, well, it certainly changes your own, over time, it will change your own synapses and your own way of interacting with your clients or with your customers. The effects of that from a schema, logic, dominant logic, shared mindset perspective, are still going to be a long time in coming, because until the organization fundamentally changes its business model and its business practices, until industrial manufacturers, stop being industrial manufacturers and start being data science companies, we're not going to see a huge amount of culture change. So I don't mean to be glib, but I think the effects of the pandemic on culture and organizations still remains to be seen. Mm-hmm. Because the impact, I think, until the core businesses is impacted, that's when you'll start to see more significant culture change. Right now, I think the effects are surface effects.
Okay, so the fact that how we work on a daily basis has changed dramatically for many. I mean, the notion of not going to an office but staying at home, being on Zoom calls all day, being able to collaborate on Teams or whatever, but being more isolated. There are many differences, right, to the way we behave now. But you, in fact, don't think that is significant enough to seriously impact culture.
Well, I think it remains to be seen, and I think it needs to be sustained. Right. So if a year from now we're back to, doing what we did a year ago, then I don't think there will be a huge impact on culture change. Having said that, I also see some changes. For example, the fact that today we have to collaborate in, in different ways. Mm. How are we collaborating these days? Well, we're certainly using Zoom in interesting ways. We're using tools like Mentimeter and, note-taking tools. And so, and this is enabling teams to actually perhaps do things that they wouldn't ordinarily do in an office environment. There's a kind of democratic effect happening in some organizations where teams are taking more initiatives to do more things using online tools. If those changes can be sustained, and that could have an impact on business practices, then I do think you will start to see culture start to change. But again, the cognitive science paradigm of culture is very closely related to how organizations work all day long. And those changes have to be sustained for cultures to take effect. Mm-hmm. Just the fact that we're talking on Zoom now versus going to an office together, in my opinion, and in the cognitive science view, is not enough.
Yeah,
and this is where we make a lot of mistakes. We think it is going to be hugely changing to culture, whereas in fact it may not.
Yeah, and the notion of we've seen, even though almost any industry, any company has been impacted, right? And we've seen many companies, or even if they're not like the hotel business, that has been extremely hard hit here. But most companies have had to make pretty significant changes, at least for the short term. And so many people have had, if you like, to be much more, open towards the new innovation, et cetera, inside the organizations than what they would otherwise have been. And following this logic here, if that isn't a something that continues to happen, and then that will also not sustain itself in culture, it will just have been events, and then we actually go back to normal.
Exactly. Yeah. And again, think in terms of impacts to the business model and to core business practices, and then you start to see where culture change really happens.
So on that note, maybe closing off here, your best advice to people out there, leaders who want to take something really bad, the pandemic and all its effects on business, but taking it and turning it into something good. What's your best advice to use this situation now to create stronger culture?
My best advice would be, as I have said already, is use the time to understand and see the habits and patterns of your organization from a sort of dominant logic perspective, and then begin to try to change the practices that are keeping those logics in place, if assuming you want to change those logics. So it's sort of inverting the paradigm again and saying, you want to become a digital company as a manufacturing company. What are the logics that are keeping you in place? Remember, cultures are, we didn't mention this, but cultures are adaptive responses to environmental stresses. They're adaptive. Humans have created culture to adapt to their environments, to successfully adapt to their environments. And so cultures are always going to be optimized for the status quo. Cultures are always going to be there to preserve what you have today. So if you want to change culture, you have to really be thinking about what is it that's keeping us running in place? What is it that's keeping us in the status quo? And that's where we get to the dominant logics and start to see how these underpinnings of culture need to shift in order for cultures to shift.
Great. And that is a great insight and great advice. So we'll finish on that. And I will thank you a million times, David, for your time here. Your new book is Disrupting Corporate Culture, How Cognitive Science Alters Accepted Beliefs About Culture and Culture Change and Its Impact on Leaders and Change Agents. Thank you so much for joining us here on the podcast.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Corporate Innovation Podcast presented by Singularity University and in collaboration with Singularity U Nordic. If you liked what you heard, please spread the news, give a review, or share a link with friends and colleagues. If you have comments, questions, or suggestions for great guests on the podcast, don't hesitate to write me at chris@sunordic.org. That is Chris with a K at sunordic.org, and sign up to the newsletter on www.sunordic.org/podcast. See you on the next episode.